Hello and welcome to our new monthly mini roundup of the key moments from the Southeast Asia Travel Show's recent editions.
Our March roundup features insights from our guests Pauline Suhano in Indonesia, Inti Deun Savan in Laos, Brendan Sobey in Singapore, James Clark in Australia, and Yerit Janssen in China. Plus, of course, Hannah and myself.
So let's begin our March rewind in Indonesia with our guest Pauline Suhano, director of Jakarta-based president of Astindo, the Indonesian Travel Agents Association. Astindo recently hosted its annual travel fair, and we asked Pauline which were the hot destinations and tourism segments for Indonesian travelers. Here's her response.
The result has not come out yet, but from what I can see Japan is still popular. Japan, China, Korea, Thailand, Vietnam, Europe, and also cruise. I can say that our travel fair is one of the largest in terms of the exhibitors. We have multi-airlines, multi-destinations, and also supported by our leading members too. Some stakeholders really put their best effort to create the huge sales during our fairs by giving a very, very good deals, special deals. For example, like Resort World Cruise, they launched a very good deal for their first ever ex-Jakarta ship. So they have the, you know, Resort World 1. They will relocate from Hong Kong to Jakarta. And during this holiday season, school holiday season, June to July, this Resort World 1 will sail from Jakarta to Singapore, Port Klang, and back to Jakarta. It's a 6 days, 5 nights sailing. But the price, can you imagine? It's only 500 start from 500 Singapore dollars per person. 6 days, 5 nights. So it's very cheap and it sells like peanuts during our travel fair.
Next to Laos, where we chatted with ecotourism pioneer Inti Deun Savan about the evolution of outdoor-based adventure travel in this beautiful landlocked country. Hannah asked Inti where he saw the untapped opportunities for a developing tourism nation with such incredible natural landscapes.
Our land will cover more than 80% by the mountain. And of course, we have more than 20 national parks. And with the mountain creating a beautiful landscape and a lot of beautiful rivers. And I think we are surrounded by 5 big countries. I think on around us is a bigger population, have more tourists than Laos, except Myanmar, of course, but before we are quite close. So not only tourists that travel around us, but I think even the people, like China, of course, is one of the biggest population of the world. And I think for what we have in Laos, in terms of in the middle, I think if we market well to specific target, that because I believe that, okay, of course, you can't market just to do a mass, because Laos, we have small population, only 7 million people. And the beauty that we have, I think we have to market specifically to those people who love adventure, who love nature, who like authentic city experience. And I think that's what we need. So I think if we can really reaching them, I think it's going to be very, very good, because I think the number of tourists coming into Laos before pandemic is already 4.8. To me, is a very big number compared to Laos people, because that means every 3 of Laos service 2 tourists. That's a very big. But of course, I think we still have a lot of day tripper. I think up to 30-40% is day tripper from Thailand. They come in the morning and going back in the evening. I mean, we only have lunch, benefit for lunch. And some of the tourists passing by to Vietnam from Thailand. So they also stop to Laos just for a lunch. So I think if we can change them that, I mean, adding more activities, developing some good attraction to stop them. I think by them passing by, I think it's already good. I think they want to stop, but I think we have to do something to stop them to enjoy, I'm sure. I mean, Green Discovery ourselves is also working very hard on that. And we also try to promote for a younger generation to develop for like something like what we do, because I believe that we need more operator that doing this adventure activity, so Laos can become the destination for eco, for adventure in the region.
At the beginning of March, while Hannah was away at ITB in Berlin, I chatted with Singapore-based aviation analyst Brendan Sobey about the current state of Southeast Asia's air travel recovery 2 years after the borders reopened in the region. We began by discussing what Brendan described as a flip around from domestic to international air capacity growth across the region, which has kind of surprised us all.
Well, it's really one of these glass half full, glass half empty kind of things, right? Certainly, a lot of people were pleasantly surprised by the recoveries, but particularly in the first, you know, year or 2 years, how fast it came, and from an airline perspective, the financial recovery was, you know, for many of the airlines, at least in the region, not all, it was better than expected. And you know, that pent up demand obviously led to this situation where demand was well above supply, and you know, that made for some good times for many of the airlines in the region. So, but now, you know, things have shifted a little bit in the last several months. You know, we're seeing a lot of other challenges, and it's become, you know, less of a supply issue, and we're seeing, you know, more of a demand issue now, at least in some markets.
And you recently posted about the regional recovery rates in terms of international versus domestic recovery, which surprised many of us, I think yourself included, particularly given where we were a couple of years ago. Can you kind of fill us in with that analysis?
Yeah, so initially, you know, everybody thought there'd be a quite a rapid and full domestic recovery, just because people were traveling domestically kind of before borders reopened. It got a kind of a bit of a head start. In some countries, there was decent amount of domestic travel, of course, during the pandemic as well. People got more used to domestic holidays. There was a lot of new domestic routes, like new point-to-point domestic routes that were launched, especially towards the end of the pandemic. So there was a lot of expectation that, you know, domestic markets would fully recover across Southeast Asia, because they were almost already fully recovered. And you know, so the gap wasn't that high. That actually hasn't happened in all the countries, in particularly Thailand, Indonesia, and Malaysia hasn't had a full domestic recovery. Vietnam and Philippines has, although Vietnam has slowed down significantly. They were already fully recovered from a domestic perspective in 2022. And in 2023, they contracted slightly. In 2024, they are contracting further, actually, although they're still above pre-COVID levels, at least a bit. So it's really flipped around. And it's quite interesting. And at this point, if you look at markets like Indonesia, Malaysia, and Thailand, it's hard to actually see airline capacity in the domestic markets coming back fully anytime soon. It could be years. It could be like a permanent shift in at least some of these markets. So that's something that's you know, a trend that I think we're going to continue to follow internationally. In Southeast Asia, we're almost at 90%. You know, of course, it varies by market. But domestically, again, of the five main domestic markets, two are fully recovered, and the other three are well behind the international figure.
Moving on to Thailand, where Prime Minister Shweta Thevisin was profiled on the cover of Time magazine for his efforts to sell Thailand as a destination for trade, investment, and tourism. Here's what Gary and I had to say about his recent headline-making trip to Europe.
It's interesting that, you know, the Thai Prime Minister only came into power last year after the delayed and quite controversial election. You know, he's been traveling the world trying to sell Thailand. I think it's 14 countries that he's been to so far. He was in Germany, obviously, last week, been to Davos, been to ITB Asia. And he's currently on the front of Time magazine this week, where they're calling him, the headline calls him the salesman, because he's basically trying to sell Thailand, to sell trade and foreign direct investment, which goes back to our interview with Vincent Vadakkan, which I think was that earlier this year, where he said exactly the same. You know, this soft power elements that the Prime Minister wants to promote about Thailand isn't just about tourism. Tourism is a big part of it, but it's basically selling the country as a destination for investment as well as travelers. Because as the article in Time this week says, the Prime Minister says that Thailand is still in an economic crisis and it's trying to find its way out, and tourism is going to be front and center of doing that.
Yeah, I found that really interesting as well, that he was on the front cover. And I wondered how many other Southeast Asian prime ministers have made it to the front cover of Time magazine recently, or for the perhaps the right reasons rather than sometimes the more infamous reasons that Southeast Asia gets in the spotlight when it comes to politicians.
Yeah, the only one I could think of is Jokowi, probably.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, he would be there. So it's kind of fascinating. He's really on this sales mission. You know, he seems to have been making progress, at least with the Schengen visa requirement that Thais have to go through to enter Europe. It seems now that he has Macron's support to try to get that waived. And if he did, that would be a massive deal for Thailand. I can imagine that would ease, of course, not only tourism, but, you know, just business between the two countries as well, and you know, forge Europe and Thailand closer together. So he's playing a clever game, I think, Shweta.
Proposals for high-speed rail networks are a hot topic across the region. We keep reading more and more about how China is linking Southeast Asia by railway. To dive deeper, we welcome back to the show James Clark, founder of the Future Southeast Asia newsletter. Here's an extract from our discussion about the long-touted north-to-south high-speed railway in Vietnam. Will it ever happen? High-speed railways again. Let's look at Vietnam, James. I think we did discuss this briefly last year. It's been on the books for a long time. This is the north-south railway running from basically the Chinese border right down to Ho Chi Minh City in the south of Vietnam. We read a lot about this. There's a lot of proposals. Is there anything concrete yet?
Nothing concrete, because I don't think we could say anything concrete until you start seeing the concrete trucks turning up and building. And maybe we probably shouldn't be talking about it anymore until that happens, because I've got a record of, like, it goes back 20 years of all the times that they've proposed building it. And it went a bit cold for a while, but it's really heated up over the last few years. And they're now at the point where the project is being submitted to the Politburo in this month. So that's the latest update. Over the last year, they've mainly been debating about what the speed should be, because they all agree that it'll be high speed, but you know, there's different levels of high speed and what it should be. So there was a debate of whether it should be like a 250-kilometre speed or 350-kilometre-an-hour speed. So 350 kilometres would be up there with the top, you know, the fastest trains in the world, like the fastest ones in China and the Whoosh in Indonesia. Whereas 250 is sort of probably more like the high speeds of Europe. And there were people talking about, why not just have it like 160 kilometres, which is semi-high speed, like what they have in Laos, China Railway. But I think they're set on going for high speed. The main thing is I worked out that they wanted to have a train that went from Hanoi to Ho Chi Minh City in 5 hours. And to do that, they would need it to have a 350-kilometre-an-hour train to get, so it would include stops and that.
Next to China and our guest, Shanghai-based UN tourism consultant Yurith Jansen. Last November, China stunned everyone by introducing visa-free access for a hand-picked selection of countries, including Malaysia. It's continued adding to the list. So how has this remarkable turnaround been received in China?
Really, inbound travel has taken on a new meaning, really. It didn't really get much coverage before the pandemic. Most of the global interest in terms of Chinese travel and tourism was outbound. There was some interest in what's happening domestically, obviously, because it's such a massive market. And even during the pandemic, it retained its status as the world's second largest air market, purely on the based on its domestic sector. But inbound travel has become something that's quite interesting, because the government has actually shifted its policy stance. If you remember, we can recap what's actually happened over recent months. Back in November, on the 24th of November last year, 2023, China announced almost out of nowhere that it will provide visa-free entry for up to 15 days for citizens from 5 European countries, France, Germany, Italy, Netherlands, and Spain, and one Asian nation, Malaysia. That scheme is going to run on a year basis as a pilot. It ran from 1st of December last year up to 31st of November 2024. It subsequently added bilateral visa-free access deals with Singapore and Thailand. Brunei was already included on visa-free travel to China. Yesterday, China's formalized a start date of the 14th of March for more European countries, Ireland and Switzerland, Hungary, Austria, Belgium, and Luxembourg, which I think, if my math is correct, brings the list to 15 countries. So that's a lot of statistics. That's a lot of countries, Jarrett. Why is this happening now? What's the rationale behind this move towards pushing inbound tourism much stronger than probably ever before?
This is an incredibly interesting topic, Gary. For us, honestly, even working in the tourism industry in China, this came as a shock as well when the first countries were announced. Now we're just assuming that more will follow throughout the year. What I see in the news the most is that people are talking about how this is going to affect outbound tourism. From my perspective, the number one priority in China is not even to bring tourists in, but it's to revitalize the economy. And this is mainly focused, I think, on business travel, on FDI, on foreign direct investment. And of course, tourism in itself can be a soft power method of bringing people close together. And in my experience, when people from different countries and different cultural backgrounds meet, they tend to forget all the superficial things they've been reading in the media, which are generally very one-sided and very, very much biased. So it's of course a good way for China to bring in more people, have more people experience what China's really like, and also bring in more money, because the current situation of the economy isn't great. A lot of media have been talking about this. It's not as bad, I think, as international media are describing. But I would say if there's one priority for the country, then this is it. And of course, this opens up a lot of opportunities, because inbound tourism has been, you can consider it, close to zero over the last years, between the COVID years. And now we finally see an opportunity to hopefully try and get back to pre-COVID numbers.
And finally, earlier this month, Hannah and I discussed the increase in air passenger charges at airports in Malaysia and how these are indicative of the passing on of cost rises to travelers across the region. Here's a short passage from that debate to end the show. See you next time. But I guess what this really shows, Hannah, is this general trend that we've definitely seen throughout the region and beyond the region, actually worldwide, of passing off costs onto travelers increasingly, whether that comes down to entry fees to countries, visa rights, that kind of thing, airport passenger service, hotel fees, accommodation fees, those kind of things. It is becoming generally more expensive to travel because of these ancillary charges, in addition to what you're used to paying in terms of your flight, your hotel, your own travel costs. These extra costs are increasing, aren't they?
Absolutely. And to add to that, even Singapore's proposed SAF fee, which will be given to consumers. It is getting increasingly expensive, and there's no real feeling that things are going to decrease yet. Of course, you know, that feeds into, there's been a lot of headlines recently, particularly around this festive travel with very high domestic airfares. And how do you resolve that? And can you resolve that? And how do you set ceiling fares? Or do you lower them? Do you raise them? And all of these other kind of issues that are ongoing really in the Southeast Asian aviation scene right now.